Okay, it's a pleasure to be here. In trying to figure out what I should say today, I felt kind of like that I'd been asked to make a piece for a jigsaw puzzle, and the person who commissioned it, people commissioned it, had an idea what the whole picture was going to be, but I was only asked to make this one piece. So I'm going to do this and hope that my piece fits in with the larger jigsaw puzzle, but I might need to refine some of the edges. Okay, so let's see if I can master this.
The right hand button.
Ah, it works. Okay, so I want to sort of set the stage for the way I think about this problem of the adaptive value of social bonds. And my thinking is shaped by my training as a behavioral ecologist. So people like me think about sociality as a set of trade-offs. Living in groups provides a variety of benefits, one of which is greater safety from predators. But there are certain costs that come along with living in social groups, which include more competition for resources. Whoops. Okay, sorry. And so we expect natural selection to favor certain kinds of traits that help individuals deal with those trade-offs. So we see things in nature like weapons, which enhance fighting ability. We see that in some species, animals form alliances which enhance individuals' power in contests. And then there are traits that may reduce the cost of conflict. Those are what I've really been interested in lately. So social bonds may serve this function in a variety of ways. And one of those ways is by reducing stress. These are Siberian hamsters, which I understand in nature, females form strong bonds, often with their sisters, and access to close companions enhances, reduces stress, and enhances things like wound healing. Okay, so I'm interested and want to talk today about how baboon females deal with this kind of trade-off. And my idea is that animals use social strategies that help them increase the benefits that they get from living in social groups and reduce the costs. So basically things that enhance the benefit-cost ratio, and that social strategies that we see in nature have evolved because they help animals enhance this trade-off. Okay. So how do baboons living in a world that's in which conflict is always a threat and which influences their access to resources, how do they cope with that? And I want to argue that social bonds provide a way for female baboons to help them enhance the benefits and reduce the costs from living in social groups. Okay, so this is a brief overview of where I'm going and the findings that I'm going to talk about. So we find that that females have preferred partners. I'll show you some data. Close social bonds seem to have distinct properties, which I will describe. And these social bonds, these close social bonds, seem to enhance females' welfare, both in the short term and in the long term. And then finally, I want to touch on what might be an important question, which is what contributes to variation in sociality among individuals. Okay, so I'm going to draw on data from two sources. One is long-term data from the Amboseli Baboon Research Project in Kenya, which I know a lot of you already know a lot about. I worked on that project as a postdoc. I returned to work on that project many years later and have been privileged to work on the archival long-term data from Amboseli. I've also worked on a baboon project in Botswana, in the Okavango Delta, which is really one of the great wild spots on the planet. That project collected data from 1991 to 2007, and I worked with Robert Seifroth and Dorothy Cheney. And again, I was worked at the site, and I also, but mainly what I'm going to draw on is long-term data that were collected at that site, which allows me to perform many of the same analyses that we performed with the Amboseli data. I'm going to show you data that comes either from Mereni or Amboseli, and the thing that's important to note is it really doesn't matter where the graph comes from. They all look the same. So that the patterns of female behavior at these two sites, which are thousands of miles apart, are remarkably similar. So what I can show you from Amboseli, I can replicate in Mereni, but I won't, in most cases, won't show you both sets of data. Okay, so there's a similar social organization at both sites, which enhances the comparison. So males disperse at both sites, females are philopatric, females inherit their mother's rank, and they form strong kin ties. So females at these sites look very much alike. So the first element of the analysis is about partner choice. And we've developed metrics for measuring what I call the strength of social bonds based on the frequency with which females associate together, spend time together, and groom one another. And the composite index of sociality, as we call it, demonstrates that there's tremendous variation in the strength of social bonds, in how often females are associating and grooming, and it obviously has this extreme J shape. So there are some very weak social bonds and a few very strong social bonds. Okay, so who are those preferred partners? Well, consistent with everything we know about social behavior in primates, there are strong nepotistic relationships among females. Females have very strong relationships with their mothers and daughters and their sisters, and then there's a pretty major drop-off with aunts and nieces, cousins. Females also show preferences for their peers. These are data from Mereni, where there's a really big drop-off from females who are within about 3 months of age and other females. And we suspect and have some evidence from Amboseli to show that this preference for peers reflects the fact that females who are about the same age are likely to have the same father because of the degree of reproductive skew within groups. And so these girls who are close in age are likely paternal sisters. So kinship has a very strong role in determining the strength of social bonds. The other factor from both sides is that strong social bonds tend to be very stable over time. And so what you see here is basically the conditional probability that females of a given category will be their preferred partners, their favorite top best friends over a period of time. So this is a bit complicated, but what I want you to see is that mothers and daughters in particular, and sisters to a lesser extent, tend to be favored partners, best friends, whatever, as long as they're together in the group. There's a decline. But if you do various kinds of analysis, what you see in the data from both sides is that females' top partners, their favorite partner, their second favorite partner, their third favorite partners, these relationships are significantly more stable than you'd expect by chance if they were choosing their partners at random. And as long as and certain categories of partners tend to have strong bonds whenever they're co-resident in the group. So these are stable, strong and stable preferences for preferred categories of partners. Work that I've been have done and I'm now kind of revisiting suggests that these very strong social bonds have certain distinctive qualities. And here I'm going to focus on the top 10%. I'm going to categorize social bonds by whether or not they're among the top 10% of all social bonds, so this really in the 90th percentile, or everything else. Okay? So these are what I'm going to call top partners. And as you might expect from what I've already told you, the distribution of top partners is clearly skewed toward kin. So if you look at mothers and daughters, is there a pointer here as well? Oh, this is probably a pointer. Ah, here. Most mothers and daughters fall within this category of top partner. And as you'd expect, based on the results we already saw, this declines as degree of relatedness declines. Now, what I also want you to see, though, is that there's some females out here that aren't related and aren't even peers, which still have these strong bonds. So there is some disassociation between the strength of bonds and kinship, although those variables tend to be highly correlated. Okay, and you're going to see why I did this in a minute. Okay, so what I've done here is I've made an effort to illustrate what relationship quality or relationship strength, what effects there are that are independent of kinship. So for each category, I've divided up dyads in terms of whether or not they're top partners or in this other category. Okay? And what you can see is that this measure is how equitably grooming is distributed. So grooming is this wonderful directional measure. I can groom you, I can groom Jim can groom me, or we could groom each other, equal amounts. So I have a measure of how equitably grooming is distributed within dyads. And down here, it's very inequitable, and up here, it's fully balanced. Okay, so how equitable is grooming? And you can see that for females with their top partners, grooming is more equitable. And what's really striking here is that when you look at non-kin dyads, females who are unrelated, you see that their relationships with their top partners are different than their relationships with others. So there's something about relationship strength that's influencing other aspects of their social relationships or their social interactions. So females that have strong bonds, where is that thing? Strong bonds seem to have more equitable grooming relationships. And to some extent, this is independent of kinship. Okay. Social bonds, close social bonds, also tend to be supportive. This data is based on the rate of support in agonistic encounters, coalitionary support. And again, you can see this pattern that females are more likely to support their top partners than they are to support others. And the likelihood of giving support is influenced by both kinship and the strength of the relationship. And close social bonds tend to be tolerant. Now, tolerance, my measure of tolerance is based on the proportion of all interactions that are friendly. So, I don't know, I've got two sisters, we fought constantly. My mother was an only child, she thought it was just a tragedy, right? But we did, we fought all the time. But we also had a lot of positive interactions. So the question is, what fraction of our interactions were hostile? In my case, I think they mainly were. But for baboon sisters, what you see is that although they do fight a lot, baboon sisters fight a lot, but the proportion of all their interactions that are hostile is still low. So this is actually the fraction of affiliative interactions. So obviously you can swap it around either way. But here the point is that although there's an effect of kinship on the fraction of affiliative interactions, the sort of tenor of the relationship, the degree of tolerance in the relationship, there's also an effect of the quality or strength of the social bond. So females that have stronger social bonds tend to be more tolerant of one another. They tend to have a higher fraction of affiliative interactions and a lower fraction of negative interactions. And so this is a result that's influenced by kinship and also influenced independently by the strength of the social relationship. Okay, so females form these close social bonds. They get support from their favored partners. And we know that agonistic support plays a role in the establishment of dominance hierarchies. What else might these relationships do for females? And this has really been something that we've just collectively been able to begin assessing with the innovations in doing endocrinology in the field. So now I'm going to turn to data that were collected at Miramie by a collection of people. This one was Angus, the first author on this paper. So it turns out that females form these strong bonds, and this study examined the impact of the loss of a preferred social partner. Lost is a euphemistic word for killed by a leopard in the night. Anyway, the impact of the loss of a relative on cortisol levels. So this is a change in cortisol level from before this happened to after it happened. And you would think that everybody might be kind of disturbed by a leopard marauding through the group in the night, and I think that's probably the case. But females who have actually lost a close relative who is likely to be a highly preferred partner have a stronger response than control females, which are just females that lived through the same event but didn't lose a close partner themselves. These are data that were collected and analyzed by Kathy Crockford and Ramon Wittig and others. And what they show is the impact of a tight or loose grooming network on cortisol levels. And it's corrected for females' reproductive states. But what you see is that for cycling, pregnant, and lactating females, females that have a low grooming diversity, which means a tighter social grooming network, have lower cortisol levels. So this suggests that having a set of females from whom you give and get most of your grooming has an impact on reducing cortisol levels. So that's the sort of short-term welfare part of the story. But those of us who go out there and collect data on grooming and proximity and other kinds of social interactions are generally operating under the assumption that the patterns of social interactions that we see are the product of selection. And if that's the case, then all of this should have some impact on fitness. Now, mostly we assume that we couldn't actually make the connection between things like grooming and fitness because, after all, how important could a single act of grooming be? But we took this big leap with the Amboseli data, which was to ask, well, if we have this detailed data on social behavior and we have this immense, valuable, long-term data on female reproductive performance, we ought to try to put them together and see what we get. I have to say that I was prompted to do this by a close friend, Lynn Fairbanks, who said, "You really should do that, Joan." And I said, "But it won't work." And she said, "Well, that's not a good reason, basically." So this is thanks to Lynn, who made me do it. Peer pressure, probably. Anyway, so we're going to look at two important elements female fitness that we know matter in terms of variation in long-term fitness, infant survival, and female longevity. Okay, so these are the original analyses that we did in Amboseli. This is a sociality index based on individuals, not dyads. I could discuss the details if you wish. This is just a representation of the data. But what we see here is that females, here I've just, for illustration purposes, grouped females into quartiles based on a measure of their social integration. Okay, these are females that are highly integrated, these are females that are poorly integrated, and this is a measure of infant survival. And what you can see is that females who are have high composite sociality indexes, females who are well integrated, reproduce more successfully than others. And this controls for differences in female dominance rank and differences in environmental conditions that existed at different times during the study that affect both levels of sociality and possibly reproductive performance. So something about how social females are is influencing the survivorship of their infants. Now, this result was great, made us all very happy, but made me really nervous, right? Because we all know that you can get lucky, you know? But lucky, you know, lucky doesn't mean it's true. So one of the really great things about being asked to look at the Marami data, or being able to look at the Marami data, was that we had a chance to see whether or not the same result would hold in a completely different population, which is, you know, replication is important. And so I've analyzed the data a little differently here. And again, for illustrative purposes, I've grouped the data into, rather than looked at it as a continuous measure, but I've asked, how does the sociality of the mother, how does the strength of her social bonds influence the survivorship of her infants? And here, the infant is a unit of analysis. These are females that are in the highest third in terms of sociality. These are the females that are in the lowest third, and these are the females in the middle. And what you can see clearly here is that if your mom was in the lowest third in terms of this sociality measure, then you're less likely to survive to various ages than if your mother is up here. So having a mother who has stronger social bonds seems to provide some kind of protective effect on infants. So the result from Amboseli seems very similar to the result that we see here in Marami. And then I started to sleep a little better. But in Marami, we also decided to look at longevity. So this is a measure which asks, this is an analysis which asks, how does the sociality of the mother, of a female, influence how long she lives? We saw these data in a slightly different form the other day. So again, you see that these highly social females seem to have an advantage over other females here in longevity, which is another important source of variation in lifetime fitness for female baboons. Okay, so that's all great. It's all very interesting. It suggests that there are all kinds of interesting dynamics going on that link sociality to fitness outcomes. But it raises other questions that we're beginning to address, right? So if being social has all these protective and beneficial effects, why isn't everybody social? And that's a really important question. We've begun to kind of think about that, and we haven't gotten that far yet, but I thought I'd just discuss a few of these things because I think they're interesting. So here's a female all alone, not very social, you know? So what's her problem? Well, one problem might be that she hasn't got any relatives in the group. So the number of close maternal kin, mothers, daughters, and sisters, influences the number of very strong bonds that females form. So that's, you know, some of this, so some of the variation is probably just demographic and stochastic. That if you happen to live in a group with your mom, you're all set, because mom's your best friend for life. If you have a daughter that matures in the group, when she matures, you have another very, another preferred partner. But if you don't happen to have your mother in the group when you mature, and if you don't happen to produce daughters, and you don't have very many close kin, you may not form very many strong bonds. On the other hand, if you don't have any close kin, you still have maybe a few strong bonds. So some of the variation, I think, is probably stochastic demographic variation in whether or not you've got member that you live in a group with other close female relatives. But the another part of the story may have to do with something that we'll loosely call temperament. And there's been a lot of interest in temperament in our field lately. And this is an analysis that Robert Seifarth and Dorothy Cheney did with tabulations that we produced from the RIM data. So I am, my only role in this part of the project is the data slave part, but that's what I like, so we're all very happy. And so in analyzing the data, there are three factors that emerge. And this ones that are named loner, nice, and aloof, and I'll show you what those are like. So loners tend to have low rates of affiliation. They tend to grunt to higher-ranking females at high rates. Grunts are signals of benign intent. Females, when they give them, they show that they're not going to be aggressive. They're reliable, predictive signals of nice things to follow. Females often give them to high-ranking females to as an appeasement. They give them to mothers of new infants to allow them to get permission to handle babies. Anyway, so grunting to high-ranking females is kind of a more obligatory form of grunting. And loners are often alone. Not surprising. The question is, you know, why do you name them? Why do you name the factors this way? Aloof females are fairly aggressive to others. They have fairly low rates of affiliation. And again, they grunt mainly when they need to high-ranking females. Females that Robert calls nice have very high rates of affiliation, and they grunt to anybody. They grunt to low-ranking females, they grunt to high-ranking females, they come up and say, hi, how are you, I'm not going to hurt you. So that's kind of their modus operandi. This is obviously anthropomorphizing slightly, but we do that. And the point here is that these aspects of temperament or behavioral style, however you want to call them, which are based on, so I want to point out that all those measures, the behavioral measures that go into building those factors, are separate from our measures of the sociality index. And it turns out here, the main point here is that the sociality index is correlated with some aspects of personality. And so not surprisingly, those very nice females tend to have high levels of the sociality index. So it could be that temperamental variation amongst females contributes to how sociable they are. So to conclude, we think that female baboons use social tactics to enhance their benefit-cost ratios. We have been able to identify certain qualities of these close social bonds. We think that these social bonds help females cope with stress in their everyday lives. We have some evidence that they are that they enhance females' lifetime fitness. And some of the variation may be related to aspects of females' personality, and that may or may not, we don't know yet, have be related to either early experience or difference in the genes that they carry. Thank you very much.